Amelia Pack Harvey came to the Las Vegas Review-Journal from Massachusetts 3 years ago. She was assigned the education desk. Her reporting has been insightful, her stories have been well-written, and her point of view in her weekly column has portrayed nothing less than astonishment. Amelia left at the end of the year to cover City Hall for the Indy Star in Indianapolis. We did an exit interview with her as she was making her way across the country. Amelia, thank you for stopping on the road on the way to Indianapolis to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks, Carrie, for having me.
Correct me if I'm wrong about your weekly columns. What I saw in them was definitely astonishment at what you were covering, the craziness of what you were covering.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to kind of leave room in each of those columns for stuff that probably wouldn't usually make it into stories, but were still worth mentioning.
What is it that you expected to find here, and what is it that you found?
That is such a good question, because I was thinking as I wrote my last column, what was I really expecting? I don't know that I had any expectations, and I think in a way that kind of very much underprepared me for covering education in Vegas. I don't think I was aware of the severe needs that I saw. I came from a, high needs community in Massachusetts, very diverse, urban district. So I kind of naively thought, you know, oh, it's going to be kind of the same, or it'll be the same issues that I see. And those, you know, large urban districts with high poverty populations, yeah, they all have the same challenges to a certain extent. But there was just so much more beyond that that encompassed Vegas education that I just kind of learned along the way.
Okay, so let's dig down on that. What were the issues that you saw here in Las Vegas?
I think right off the bat, and I wrote about this in a column about my transition from Massachusetts to Vegas. That was actually, I got tons of feedback on. I didn't know that I had struck a nerve, but a lot of people wrote to me after it ran saying that they were glad that I wrote it because they'd all, you know, thought the same thing. I think the thing that struck me most as a journalist was this kind of eerie feeling that I was the only one asking for data and information that in other places maybe 50 other reporters were asking for.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of felt instantly like this burden of no one else is paying attention to this and I need to. There was also just a kind of, when I would ask for people, I don't want to say who, but when I would ask certain things or have certain questions, that the answer or kind of the culture I got was, well, that's just how it is here. Like, this is what we got. And I'm thinking, okay, well, if that's how it is here, I mean, we're routinely at the bottom. Is that going to be your answer for forever? I mean, is that going to be the next 20, 50 years? So I was kind of like, in Massachusetts, it was always, you know, it was always like cutting edge stuff was a right. And it was a right. It wasn't a privilege. You know, there's always a push for more and more, demands for more. I still keep up with news from over there, but they just kind of were working on reforming their education funding. And everyone over there was just, you know, so astonished and outraged that their funding formula was, you know, I think it's 25 years old. And I was like, you guys have no idea. I mean, in Massachusetts, that's like, a travesty, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here it's like, well, this is the way it's done. I mean, we've never changed it and we're just going to keep doing it like that. So that was an example of kind of the stuff I saw. Overcrowding, I had never seen so many kids. I mean, I think overcrowding is an issue everywhere, certainly. I had never seen so many kids in a classroom, in some of these classrooms that I visited. I had never seen so many portables dumped onto a campus in some of the high school campuses I visited.
Mm-hmm.
The vacancies, like, there's also, again, another national problem. There's teacher vacancies everywhere. But I just hadn't realized that there were such things as, I mean, I hadn't really had much experience with the term long-term sub before.
I didn't realize
that there were so many. Yeah, I didn't realize there were so many hundreds of vacancies. That's hundreds of classrooms. That's, you know, thousands of students without a teacher at the front of the room, certified, you know, licensed teacher. And so I was just kind of shocked at that. I think the thing that shocked me the most, though, was the fact in my years there, and that's kind of what I summed up in my column that ran, is just that I kept wanting to explain to people what these issues were, try and share with them, okay, yes, CCSD is terrible sometimes, but that can't be the answer for everything. I mean, certainly there's wastes of money. Certainly there's people that are bad in the district. Certainly it's a bureaucracy. But if you keep having that as the easy answer to everything, then you're never going to change and you're never going to get better. Because if you just keep blaming that, then that's kind of like the easy way out. So I kind of tried to take it upon myself to explain these issues, explain them from beyond the whole, oh, well, CCSD is the devil, you know, and put that out there. And I think what shocked me ultimately, and even as I left, although I was used to it by then, is just no one caring. And I know it's kind of an insult to say, well, hey, you know, entire state of Nevada, you don't care. And that's not, there are people that care. There are people that work every day to fight that apathy. But I think, you know, I could be there another decade and that level of apathy would more or less still be present.
And you're talking about apathy from parents, from teachers, from just the general community, from actual CCSD employees. Where's that coming from?
I think it's across the level. I think it's also a cultural thing. It might be kind of stereotypical of me to say this, but it kind of reminded me of this whole kind of Wild West culture of, like, you know, devil may care, you know, just you do your thing, I'll do mine, kind of live free attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder kind of if that's the culture of how we were, how the state was born and raised, really, was out of the Civil War, just go west and settle and survive. And I think it's just, I wonder at times if it's just a generational, you know, cultural thing. Mm-hmm. And so apathy, I think in the terms of, obviously you can't say parents are apathetic. I mean, every parent cares about their child, more or less.
Right. But do they care about the school district?
Exactly. I just don't know the extent to which they're invested. When you have, like, as much poverty in the district as we do, it's also like, well, how much can those parents afford to be invested in the school district and go to every board meeting and drop their child off to school and pick them up and check them out and check their backpacks for guns? Like, there's a lot of working parents that are struggling in the county. And so there's that level, too. I don't think it's that they don't want, they don't care. It's just that they don't have time, you know, and that's, you know, just kind of my, you know, guess. But the other thing generally that the biggest apathy I think I saw was from the legislature.
Huh.
And that is kind of, when you have a legislature that meets every other year, that's kind of staggering to me. It's just, I don't know how you can get a lot done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the problem, too, is that I don't know, since they're not full-time, you know, you don't really get paid. I mean, I guess they do get paid, but it's not a career, right, to be
right.
A state legislator in Nevada. It's something you do on the side while you're working your other job, you have your other career. So it's hard to, when you do that and you meet every other year, it's like going to this club that you do, you know, for fun, that you, you know,
right.
You have a job, you have a career, and then you gotta, oh, well, you know, for this book club, let me read this book on the side. So it's I feel like there's just like a lot of like professionalism of that, not professionalism of the, on the behalf of the legislators, but they just don't see it. I think it needs to be treated as a professional job,
mm-hmm.
not something that we can just throw people in there and then, you know, crucify them if they don't do a good job or, you know.
So
yeah.
I agree with you completely,
yeah.
But I will say that I think that the last two points you made kind of go together, that Nevada is a leave-me-alone, libertarian kind of mindset state, and that the state government
right.
was set up in the way that it's set up because we didn't want government to tell us what to do, or the ranchers up north,
right.
because Vegas really didn't exist at that point. But talk to me
right.
about what you wrote in your last piece in the RJ, in terms of you were doing an investigation, you contacted the legislature, and nobody got back to you.
Yeah, that kind of ticked me out. I was a little bit surprised. I mean, we did this investigation into this boarding school in the middle of the desert. The owners had ties to a network of schools that their MO was to operate in places no one cares about, i.e. middle of the desert in Nevada, that where there's going to be a little oversight. And so if you're looking for that, then they got the right place. So we kind of laid it all out, spelled it all out. No one was really checking on them if they were violating, like, water issues, if they had water issues or they had abuse claims, and they just kept on getting these reports and kind of kept on pushing it off. So to me, you know, that was really astonishing. And again, I think I kind of naively thought, like, wow, this is going to really rile people out. No one cared. I mean, no one cared. And I think that for me was just like another gut punch of, oh, you know, these kids are drinking dirty water in the middle of the desert and there's no one out there to watch them and no one cared. And we contacted some legislators on different committees that could have had different oversights. And even then, being on committees that may or may not make policies or oversee these kinds of facilities, maybe you don't even have to be on a committee to read that and think, wow, I'm a legislator. How do we get this from not happening again?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the thing that really kind of upset me was we reached out to one legislator, I won't say who, but they wrote back and said, well, the RJ has blocked my access to this story. And I kept on thinking, like, what does he mean by that? I don't know what they mean. And then I thought, I think that means they don't subscribe. Like, they hit their limit of articles per month.
Oh, interesting.
And I think that's what they meant, because I later emailed back and said, do you mean you don't subscribe? And if that's the case, I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. And I think it would be embarrassing in any other state to be a legislator that doesn't subscribe to at least the two largest papers in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So in Boston, that would be maybe the Globe, the Herald. If you're out west, it would be somewhere out, the Berkshire Eagle, whichever, you know, area you represent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to have that response was just kind of, I can't be bothered because, you know, I can't read your articles because I don't pay for them. I was just kind of stunned. I was like, wow.
So in terms of CCSD, you were here when Pat Skorkowski was still here. You saw mm-hmm. the hiring of Jesus Jara and the transition. So what's your view in terms of, you know, from two different people who were leading this district?
That's a good question. I always have this kind of intrinsic, I always feel sorry for whoever is the superintendent. And I don't know why I feel sorry for that. I just always instantly feel sympathy for the person who holds that job. I think because it's so hard. I've had to fight against that instinct because I've always had it, no matter which, you know, who's in charge of which district I cover. So that aside, because it's an incredibly tough job and you couldn't pay me enough money to do it.
Right.
I think with Pat, there was a lot of, you know, he was bred in CCSD. He came from the inside. He was an educator and you know, just, and, you know, an educator at heart. And, you know, I just think there were people initially who had a lot of faith in him when he first got tapped to lead. I wasn't here at that time. But I was here, I guess, at the critical juncture of the time when things began to sour between him and the school board. You had a different school board at the time. There was a reorganization that was going on that was kind of being jammed down the district's throat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of these, like, legislative mandates that, you know, people in Carson City thought was good. Whether or not it's good, you know, it depends on, you know, how you look at it. So there was a lot of mistrust that he was having conversations with the board that he wasn't sharing, or without the board, I guess, that he wasn't sharing with the board. So that kind of started to sour, and the budget deficit,
mm-hmm.
The first one, I think that was hard for the board to stomach. And yeah, so I guess I'm guessing that he just kind of saw that it was his time to leave. I think with the new, in any kind of different leadership transition, any new superintendent that's coming in, that's bringing his or her own people, that's instilling his or her own set of goals, I mean, it's just a change of administration, right? So there's going to be people who are part of the old guard who are going to resent that. Mm-hmm. So I very much saw that when Jarrah came on board. It's a very political job. If he wants to make progress, he has to bring on people that he trusts. If he wants to make progress, he has to set, you know, firm goals. Whereas before, when I was covering Storkowski's time, there weren't any really, I think the five-year plan, if there was a five-year plan, it kind of just dwindled away because I think the legislature happened, the reorganization happened, the achievement school district happened with charter school, you know, schools potentially taking over, underperforming traditional schools. So there was a lot on their plate, and the school board was preoccupied with a lot of this stuff. And so I think achievement as a result fell by the wayside. With Jarrah, I mean, I think some people probably find it refreshing that he's actually set goals. He's going to have an evaluation. Pat never had an evaluation, and the criteria by which he's going to be evaluated is going to be, you know, set in stone. So I think with Jarrah's tenure, it's too early to see whether or not there'd be any, whether it's ultimately good or bad. It's just kind of an area of transition where people who were there are going to grumble, and people who are, you know, he's bringing on board are going to make new changes. And I think with Jarrah, too, there was a worry of choosing an internal candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a worry that there was too much of a good old boys system that I suppose people felt Pat was brought up under, but also that Pat allowed to continue to somewhat flourish. And so I think there was and I think I actually wrote a column on this. I think there was a worry about those people still being allowed to sink their teeth into the system. And I think they wanted an outsider for a fresh start. And I say they, I mean, that's going to be like one cohort of people. Obviously,
right.
There's 50 different, you know, cohorts that have 50 different opinions. Every district, I mean, in my old district, when they were looking for another superintendent, there was also that feeling, too. And there was an insider candidate, and there were external applicants. And so there's, you know, I mean, it's kind of the same mm-hmm. everywhere, more or less, school district politics are. I think the more recent story I did, too, was the principal evaluations. Are we putting people at positions of power that are qualified and ready to be in that job? There are awesome principals all throughout the district. I think there are probably principals in those jobs that shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, again, gets to the good old boy system of are you just promoting people up the ladder because it's their time, because they put in their dues, because they were a teacher and then they were a dean and then they were an AP and then they went to an AP at a different school and now they're, you know, are you doing that or are you really trying to find the best qualified people? Because if you think about it, and I never really thought about principals as powerful as they were until I came out here. Because, and you've been to SOT meetings, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, they're controlling
mm-hmm.
a budget that could be multi-million dollars, especially if you're running a high school.
Mm-hmm.
They're controlling basically their own town. I mean,
mm-hmm.
think about it like a mayor of a tiny town, right? The citizens are the kids, and your administration and your teachers are the forms of government in a way. So just making sure that we're putting those people that are qualified in those positions is one thing I kind of explored, and that was interesting to me. But I've got to go back to like what you were mentioning before is the fear that exists. When I came out here, I think told very quickly that people are very fearful of speaking out in CCSD,
mm-hmm.
and that can be teachers, that can be parents, that
mm-hmm.
can be administrators, it can be anybody. So I really had to learn for any story to gain their trust
mm-hmm.
and just accept the fact that people are only going to talk to you off the record. And when I kind of accepted that and understood it, I think I was able to glean so much more about what the issues were
mm-hmm.
than if I just got fed the district line every time from, you know, the press office or canned statements or whatever. There was so much more to it than just the press release.
Two things
yeah.
I want to add to that. One is that even at the parent meeting that was held at Valley High School about Clark's now moved, transferred principal, Antonio Rael, there were parents there who were saying to Debbie Brockett, Assistant Superintendent Debbie Brockett, that they didn't want their names used, right? I would say to them, Can I talk to you? And they would say, yes, we can talk, but I don't want my name used. There was a teacher that was there who was talking, and people were videotaping it, and I was audiotaping it. And she was like, I will talk to you for your story, but I don't even want my voice used because they'll recognize my voice. And I'm like, but you're here in an open meeting. parents were afraid, and parents had stories about how their kids were retaliated against, and teachers had stories about how they were retaliated against. And I wish I could say that this was something that I hadn't heard before, but I've heard it a lot. And the other part of the cultural thing is we don't necessarily agree what good leadership is. I have yet to see anything from CCSD that outlines what a good leader does, what a good principal does.
Right.
And so with the with the reorganization, what we ended up doing was putting more power in the principals. And I would constantly ask Pat, so where's your leadership coming from? You have a leadership problem here. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, we're training people. But I was never able to get how they were training them. What does leadership look like? And that's, to me, that is the essence of what happened at Clark. Rael may have or may have not done things that were inappropriate or whatever, but the essence of the issue there was they had this principal for 14 years who was hands-off and made it feel like a college atmosphere, and then Rael came in and started imposing rules from the top, and people didn't like that.
Right.
And that's just because we don't agree on what leadership is. So you come to CCSD to go to school, and it's not really a unified district. It's just a bunch of schools.
I couldn't agree more. And there was like a very convoluted administrator evaluation tool that you use that's, you know, state board approved. But it's kind of like, I mean, choose two of these following documentations or, you know, X, Y, and Z, or don't pass, go, you know, go straight to G. I mean, it's just like very confusing. And for that story, I looked at that performance framework and I'm just like, I mean, it's kind of, the same could be said for teacher evaluation. But it's kind of like, well, how do I, I could just be your supervisor and check all those boxes and say you did a job, you did your job.
Mm-hmm.
If you got that many people who are speaking out against you, who are leaving because of you, then maybe we need to rethink how we evaluate these people or how we place them in those positions.
And for teachers, like teachers, Are you in the class every day? Are you teaching the curriculum? Are you, there's these broad things, right? But the number one complaint that I get from students when I talk to them about a teacher that they're having problems with is that the teacher is mean, the teacher doesn't listen, the teacher has said to them, look, if you can't learn this, then go to Khan Academy. And because I can't, this is the way I teach and that I'm not doing anything else. The teacher has said sexist or racist things. And those, we don't look at those questions. And those are the things that really shut students down.
And I think, too, when we're dealing with such a vacancy issue, it's kind of like, I don't mean it as an insult, but I feel like it's kind of like, well, let's just take what we can get. Like, let's just... If you want to be a teacher, you want to apply, you want to commit yourself to these kids, then absolutely, like, go for it. And we were so grateful for you, right? But it's like, well, should they be in a classroom or should they be in the principal position or, all this stuff? But when we have that much of a shortage, it's kind of like anybody who's qualified, let's go. Let's put them in the classroom, which is mostly good, but sometimes it can be bad. Sometimes they are, sometimes it could be, we had that rash of teachers who were arrested for sexual misconduct a few years ago.
Yeah, I was in an SOT meeting when the whole Dean's thing came down, one of the SOTs I attended, and they were talking about, they wanted to keep their dean. They really loved their dean. They wanted to keep that person in, you know, maybe an AP capacity, but they would have to cut. And so they were going through what they would cut. And when it came to teachers, they were like, oh, well, we can cut the math department. We can cut some teachers out of the math department. And then somebody brought up the fact that the two teachers that had seniority in that department were, I mean, they didn't really say it, but they're not like they weren't good teachers. And so the person they would have to get rid of was actually the best teacher in the department, who had less seniority. So all they said was, oh, but that means we'd have to get rid of so-and-so because so-and-so and so-and-so have seniority. And the entire table looked at each other in horror and said, okay, well, we can't cut the math department then. So they know that there are bad teachers, but there's not a whole lot you can do if they've been there for a while.
Right, exactly. Oh, favorite stories. That's nice.
Okay.
I think all of the, I think off the bat, stories that showed the perseverance of folks in the district, whether that was students or whether that was principals. Some of the students that stuck out to me, Emmanuel was one of them. I think I profiled him in 2017, 2016. He is now, oh my gosh, I think he's at one of the Ivy Leagues. I can't remember, but he's one of those kids that you meet, the son of immigrants. Like he was so impressive. He's one of those kids you meet that he got it. He understood. He's like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get a good job, provide for my family, then go save the world. Like that is very much, I mean, he had the maturity of maturity I did not have when I was that age, a teenager in high school. So he was one of them. Another one of them, the students, I think I mentioned her in my column, Jayla, the superintendent, invited her and a few other students to the State of the State address. For some reason, I just approached her afterwards and was like, I'd love to know your story. Jackie Valley actually did a really good story, too. I didn't realize it before I started writing it, but she had already profiled her. But it was, I mean, she's also another, you know, she'd been through tremendous childhood adversity and just kind of overcame it. I mean, I'm sure, you know, not without some difficulty. And just also had that kind of wherewithal to just say, nope, I'm going to rise above. I'm going to go to Ivy League or similar college, and I'm going to, you know, get a good job. And then after that, I'm going to go save the world. Like, it was just very much like the same kind of mentality. So there's kids that are, you know, even though they're living with adversity or living in poverty or both, it's just they still, you know, I think she's at Johns Hopkins, I think now. But yeah, it's just they're so impressive and they just rise above. And then I think from the school perspective, and I also met the mom, you know, there was another story that Sierra Vista community kind of raised money for a car for this one mother of a football player. She as a mom really struck me. I think I asked her, you know, what they moved from Louisiana. They were in a bad neighborhood. She didn't want her kids to be influenced by the activities in the neighborhood. She wanted them to move. So she moved out here to Vegas. And she was like, I was like, how do you do all of this? Like, how did you do all of this? And, you know, she's got, I think, 3-4 kids. And she's like, you know, I just put my kids first, like, no matter what. No matter what, I just got to do everything for them. She's like, they're before, I think she kind of insinuated to me, they come before any man that I'm dating and anything else in my life. I just have to do it for, I saw this mom who was willing to, she saw the dangers of her community and just rerouted herself cross country and brought her children with her. And I think her children, who are all in high school, also understood that. And to understand that at that young of an age and appreciate it is just an excellent sign of maturity for me. So there was that. I mean, that was a really good feel-good community story. There's also just every school that I step into, you can kind of within 10 or so minutes tell whether it's a good cultural school to be in or if it's a little shaky, you mm-hmm. know? And every school that I've stepped into that I'm like, oh, I think the administration, the culture they built here is really, I can tell. And so I remember going into one school, it was French Elementary. They had jumped, I think, from 2 to 5 stars. It was a few years back. We hadn't had star ratings for a while, so it was the first, I think it was one of the first star ratings we had. So granted, they had a long time to improve, but that's still an impressive jump. So mm-hmm. I went, you know, over there and asked them, like, what, you know, how they did it under this principal's leadership, and she was very inviting. She's like, you know, the teacher stopped by her office, and then they sat down and started talking to me about, like, what they saw and what they thought needed to change. It was just, like, a very feel-good story about how they came together to tackle this problem and do better for the kids. And you could just see that everyone had the same buy-in. So that was, you know, every school that I've stepped into that's like that, I very much kind of appreciate. And I can't write stories about all of them every mm-hmm. time, but they're out there. They're kind of like the unsung heroes. So yeah. On the flip side, you can usually tell if the atmosphere is pretty bad and maybe there's a need for a change in leadership. But yeah. But when it's good, you can definitely tell, I think.
I have to talk to you about the media landscape here in Southern Nevada. It is, you know, when I was growing up, there were 2 newspapers a day. And then, you know, you could get national news, but it was a different era. But now it's dwindling. We don't have a real industry here. And it feels to me like to be a journalist in Las Vegas, especially, but in Nevada as a whole, is kind of like climbing uphill. You're not
right.
You're working alone. So what right. are your thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So in Massachusetts, I hate to compare everything to Mass, but
right.
in Massachusetts, since it's like a very, every town, you know, it's extremely broken down. There's over 300 school districts in that state because there's over 300 towns and municipalities.
Right.
But also for every town, like there used to be pretty much a newspaper, a town newspaper. Now, nowadays, that's obviously dying and the smaller town newspapers are going away. But there's still so much more of a concentration of media in states like that than definitely out in Nevada, where it's just a desert in every sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was one of the culture shocks. You know, when we had test score releases, we had graduation rate releases in Massachusetts. When we had any major thing, the State Department would put every reporter on a conference call. You'd sign up. There'd be like 15 reporters. You'd be vying for questions. Everyone would be looking at the data 15 different ways, 20 different ways. Everybody would be obsessing with the data of their jurisdiction, right? So I was looking at the city of Lowell. There were town reporters that were looking at their towns and all this stuff or their cities. So there were more eyes for everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
And out here, it's like I kind of, like I said before, got this eerie sense that I was sometimes the only person asking for this or thinking about this. And sometimes the answer would be, well, I've never had anyone ask for that. I mean, it was kind of pretty basic. And I was thinking, really? Like, you don't even have this on file? Because I can't think of an example in my head, but some things were just kind of, I was just like, you know, very used to asking demanding questions. And then I suddenly would ask these demanding questions and people would be struggling to answer it. So, and I think it's every place like flourishes with a strong media environment.
Mm.
On the flip side, I don't know what also supports that is people who care about being informed.
Right.
And because of the transient nature of Vegas, because of that wildness attitude, and there's not a lot of, like, you know, there's so many people coming in from California, they're just, you know, trying to make a living. I don't know that that's like a very good environment to breed subscribers, or, you know, readers who are consistent. For Nevada, there's that kind of catch-22. I feel like in Massachusetts, it's like people were born and bred in some of these small towns for ages, you know,
mm-hmm.
and their town newspaper was very much like, this is my livelihood. What I'm reading here it affects me. It affects my children. It's going to affect my grandchildren if they stay here, or if they, you know, if they move to the town next door, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there was very much of a investment. But out here, I think it's kind of a, you know, I'm just passing through kind of thing.
Okay, and I have to ask you this: we were at the RJ. What was the What was it like at the RJ? What was the feeling there? As you say you walk into a school and you can tell in 10 minutes whether the school has a really good culture or bad culture. We've all heard lots of things about the RJ. So what was the culture there?
Honestly, when I first got there, I think any journalist should be skeptical of entering that situation.
Yes. You got there in 2016, just before it was announced that Adelson had bought the paper, and then people wrote stories about that and then left, right? Okay.
Right. Actually, I got there after the Adelson purchase.
Oh,
I knew that Adelson owned the paper, and I still came. So I was I was worried, obviously, about editorial control and all that stuff. And I, to be honest, with the exception of, editors are going to tell you, we should do a story about this. That's what's going to, that drives it. Mm-hmm. How many times does an editor come to you and tell you, we got to cover this, So with those things aside, I always had freedom to do whatever I wanted, which was great. Because once I got my bearings, if I had a big project, then they would just say, go for it. And I think there's like a 6-month period where you're kind of feeling out your employer and your employer's feeling out you. But it was very much an environment where I could, if I had a big Sunday piece I wanted to explore, I would just do it because there was so much to cover here. And I just had idea after idea after idea. I'd have like so many Sunday stories. And even when I left, I still had a Sunday story list that was 10, there were at least 10 different items on it. There wasn't any, I put this sentence in and now it's mysteriously, taken out because it was politically, incorrect or something. There was none of that. I mean, obviously when you file something with your editor, they're going to put sentences in and take sentences out.
Right.
So I had a great direct editor, and he always made my stories better. He always made my writing better, which was good because the writing that you see on the page is definitely probably a few notches better than what I turned in. So that's good. I think what was kind of draining emotionally and psychologically was being labeled as, the Adelson news. And this is what Adelson wants you to know. And this is what, and I'm sitting there thinking, did you sit through that 7-hour board meeting or did I?
Right.
do you know what you're talking about? Or did I just watch that whole conversation unfold? It was sometimes just kind of having my reporting chalked up to, of course you would say that because you're the Adelson news. Was really demoralizing, and I think I got less of it because I covered schools, and it's not. I mean, it's political, but it's political in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's frustrating because I think very few places deserve more eyes on it than Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
But then to have the people in Nevada just be like, "Well, I'm not going to read you because you're the Adelson News," and then therefore just be more uninformed. It was so frustrating to me.
The last thing here is you're heading to Indianapolis and you're going to be covering City Hall. So you've been covering education. You covered education in Lowell. You covered education here.
Yeah.
Why City Hall?
I think I was ready for a new challenge. I think also, too, that nothing is as taxing to you, I guess, as a reporter when the stakes are children and not adults, not to say that their lives matter less, but when the ultimate, what it boils down to and what you could be hurting, harming, cheating are children and minors that, don't have a lot of power, that is so... It can just be taxing, as a reporter. So I'm kind of looking forward to, not to say there's not going to be people, victims and people who are helpless in a City Hall position, but it's it'll be different. I'm just kind of looking forward to a change of scenery. And everyone cares about their kids. Everyone is, protective of, I got a lot of calls from parents who were very protective of their children. They felt like they were being mistreated in some way. I think I'm kind of looking forward to getting out of that mindset and more of adults' mindset now, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Sounds a lot like what I hear from teachers in terms of burnout or in terms of secondary trauma.
Yeah, I'm sure they get a lot, too. But yeah.
We have been talking to Amelia Pack Harvey. She has left the Review Journal and Las Vegas and covering education for now to cover City Hall for the Indy Star. That would be in Indianapolis, Indiana. Amelia, thank you for talking to us this week. Very much appreciate this exit interview.
Thanks so much, Carrie, for having me.